It's Monday, January 23, 2012. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Yesterday marked the 39th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court's infamous Roe v. Wade decision, legalizing abortion on demand throughout all 50 states in the United States of America. Most Americans tend to think of that anniversary in terms of its annual arrival as a matter of cultural conflict. But for those who are deeply invested in the battle for life, it becomes a very tragic milestone, replete with statistics that tell us of the death toll of abortion just since 1973. The approximately 1.4 million abortions averaged over those years amount to more than 50 million missing Americans. That's right, 50 million abortions since 1973. Now, it took the United States of America well into the 19th century to reach 50 million in population, much less to have a statistic such as 50 million aborted human beings. Now, what we're looking at is a missing generation. James Taranto of the Wall Street Journal has spoken of this as the Roe effect, the effect of having an entire generation of 50 million people missing from a nation. The question is, are they missing from the nation's conscience? Thousands of pro-life activists will be gathering today in Washington, D.C. for the annual March to Life. Some of the statistics that they'll be considering are these. Approximately one out of three American women will at some point in her lifetime have an abortion, according to the Alan Guttmacher Institute. The number of abortions now means that approximately one out of every four pregnancies ends in abortion. In some neighborhoods, among some ethnic groups in America, the number of abortions actually far exceeds the number of live births. And finally, when it comes to all the surgical procedures that are performed on adults in America, abortion ranks near the very top. Now, when it comes to the major events that took place over this past weekend, many people go immediately to the South Carolina primary, others to the death of former Penn State coach Joe Paterno. I have to go to the White House in Washington, D.C., and to the responsibility of President Obama personally and his administration generally for adopting a truly reprehensible policy in terms of contraception coverage in the Obama health care program. The decision was due, and it came on Friday, as the administration often dumps controversial decisions late on Friday in order to avoid several days of a news cycle. The president, through his Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, announced that religious employers will have to comply with the mandate to cover preventative services, including contraception. Now, as we watch this story unfold, you can see exactly what it represents. If it is unchecked, if this policy stands, it represents a violent attack upon the very idea of religious liberty and religious conscience. Here are the issues. When the Obamacare legislation was put into effect, the qualified plans would have to cover free preventative services. The administration ruled that contraception was among those free preventative services. It further ruled that this involves almost all forms of contraception, including Plan B, or the morning after pill. The Obamacare legislation included what is called a religious exemption, but it is for churches and synagogues. It does not cover any religious organization sponsored by a church or a denomination or a synagogue, or for that matter, any other religious body that involves those from outside the faith group in terms of its services or employment. That means, for instance, that a Catholic hospital is now considered a secular hospital. It comes under the mandate. And even against Catholic concerns about all contraception, they're being required to offer a health care program to employees that would include contraception. Now, when it comes to evangelicals who have an increased concern about contraception, the larger issue is going to be Plan B, or the required covering as a free service to employees, an abortifacient. That is to say, a pill that either customarily or occasionally will cause an abortion rather than preventing conception. When Secretary Sebelius announced the details of the plan this past Friday, she said this, "Scientists have abundant evidence that birth control has significant health benefits for women. It is documented to significantly reduce health costs," end quote. In a literal slap in the face to religious employers, the administration said that it would offer a one-year delay with a deadline of August 1, 2013 for religious employers to determine how they can, quote, comply, end quote, with the new regulations. Timothy M. Dolan, the Roman Catholic Archbishop of New York, who had personally met with President Obama to express his church's concerns, said this, "In effect, the president is saying we have a year to figure out how to violate our consciences." In a bold confrontation with the administration, the Archbishop simply said this, "We are unable to live with this." Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, a Mormon, said this, "The problem is not that religious institutions do not have enough time to comply. It is that they are forced to comply at all. Unfortunately, the administration has shown a complete lack of regard for our constitutional commitment to religious liberty." End quote. We should note that it is not just Roman Catholics and Mormons who are concerned about this. Evangelicals have also been at the forefront. The National Association of Evangelicals said that the White House decision set up a situation in which, quote, employers with religious objections to contraception will be forced to pay for services and procedures they believe are morally wrong. End quote. That is exactly the case. The backlash to this is going to be considerable, and court challenges are inevitable. If this stands, it means a very serious conscription of religious liberty. We should note that in yesterday's edition, the Washington Post, one of the nation's most influential and liberal newspapers, editorialized against the Obama administration's policy. It referred to the administration's decision to delay the compliance order for a year as, quote, unproductive can-kicking, end quote. And then the paper said this, quote, "The best approach would have been for HHS to stick to its original conclusion that contraception coverage should generally be required, but to expand the scope of the proposed exemption for religiously affiliated employers who claim covering contraception would violate their religious views." Many observers in Washington have been left scratching their heads, wondering aloud why the Obama administration would take on the Roman Catholic Church, evangelicals, and others so directly in an election year. If anything, this demonstrates the power of liberal lobbying groups within the Obama administration, and it also indicates a new stridency on these issues coming from the president himself, who was confronted personally about these issues and has made his decision, nonetheless. And speaking of the election, last Saturday's primary in South Carolina was a game changer. How exactly does it change the game? No one knows. As a matter of fact, at this point, the game just appears on for the 2012 Republican presidential nomination. Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House, won in South Carolina, garnering 40% of the vote. Mitt Romney came in second with 28%, Rick Santorum with 17%, Ron Paul third with 13%. Embarrassingly enough, in terms of the Ohio caucuses, it was all of a sudden announced that it actually had been Rick Santorum who had won the caucuses 2 weeks ago, and not former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney did win the New Hampshire primary, so if you're keeping score, that means Santorum won with Iowa, Mitt Romney won with New Hampshire, and now former Speaker Newt Gingrich won with South Carolina. The action now moves to Florida, where in 10 days, the Sunshine State will hold its own primary. Now, if right now what we saw in South Carolina was a game changer, what's going on in Florida could be a game ender. But it's too early to tell. Far too early to tell. Now, in terms of the breakdown of the South Carolina primary vote, the interesting phenomenon is the fact that Rick Santorum, who had been endorsed by a group of evangelicals who met in Texas just the previous weekend, actually got less of the evangelical vote than former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. It was Newt Gingrich who garnered the largest percent of evangelical voters, about 44%. Romney got 22, and Santorum 21. If nothing else, this indicates that the endorsement was not all that influential. What it means for the future remains to be seen. The interesting thing, of course, in terms of the South Carolina primary is how the issue of personal character and credibility has now been focused especially on the former Speaker of the House, who is now on his third marriage. Meanwhile, Mitt Romney, who had been the frontrunner, and for that matter may still be the frontrunner, we simply don't know, was put in a defensive position concerning his income, his investments, and his income tax returns. All that's likely to be reshaped in coming days. As a matter of fact, the Florida primary looms so large now on the political horizon that any number of reshapings could take place just in a matter of the next week. We'll all stay tuned and watch. Oh, and by the way, even as the national media gave so much attention to the percentage of participants in the Iowa caucuses who identified themselves as evangelicals, it turned out that that percentage was even higher among those who voted in South Carolina. 65% of those who identified themselves to pollsters identified themselves as evangelical Christians. The importance of that fact is this. In terms of the primary calendar, we will not face anything like that kind of percentage of evangelical influence in the next few primaries on the schedule. The death yesterday of Penn State's legendary football coach Joe Paterno leads America to a very mixed moral moment. One of those moments in which there will be a great deal of media attention, but there will also be a difficult question hanging in the air. What exactly do we do with Mr. Paterno at this particular point in history? One of the things Christians should consider in this case is what this means in terms of how quickly a reputation can change. Just 3 or 4 months ago, Joe Paterno was absolutely synonymous with integrity in college athletics. As a matter of fact, he was considered one of those very few coaches who held his team and his university to a very high standard. Graduation rates were high, even as was the win count for the football team. But of course, all that changed just late last year with the disclosure of a massive sex scandal at Penn State University involving the sexual abuse of young boys by the former head coach's assistant, Jerry Sandusky. The big issue here, of course, was not just what happened to the boys, but what happened within the university, where it appears that nothing less than a cover-up took place. Mr. Paterno was not charged with being a part of that cover-up. He indeed had reported the report that came to him of the sexual abuse of a boy to university authorities, but he did nothing thereafter. And a series of additional boys were subjected to sexual abuse, which could have been prevented had Mr. Paterno gone to authorities outside the university, which he did not do. The moral nature of the universe God has created becomes apparent all around us, including in events like this, which become morality tales for our times. Just consider this. On October the 29th of last year, Joe Paterno won his 409th game, becoming the winningest coach in Division I college football history. He was highly honored, and yet just a matter of about 10 days later, he was fired by the Board of Trustees after the disclosure to the public of the sex abuse scandal. Then, on January the 22nd, yesterday, he died of lung cancer. That lung cancer having been discovered due to a bronchial infection just a few weeks before the end of last year. He spent 46 years as coach there at Penn State University, almost 5 decades of service. He compiled 409 wins, 136 defeats, and 3 ties. He took his team to 37 bowl games, of which they won 24. Like the University of Alabama's legendary coach Bear Bryant, he died approximately just 9 weeks after he left his job as a head coach and won his last game. When I look at this particular case, I'm humbled by the fact that here was a leader who was in the game for almost 5 decades and was considered one of the greatest winners of his time and a man of upright character. And then at the very end of his career, at the very end of his tenure, it ends in disaster. And that disaster then unfolds into a very untimely death. If nothing else, the death yesterday of Joe Paterno should serve as a great sobering moment for all of us, remembering not only that we will face the verdict of history, but the verdict of a righteous God. Another transition was marked over the weekend when Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords released a video in which she announced that she would be leaving office. She has been fighting a brave fight for recovery since the January 8, 2011 tragedy in Tucson, in which 19 persons were shot, leaving 6 dead. The congresswoman herself was shot in the head, and her survival, much less her partial recovery, is nothing less than remarkable. Regardless of your partisan affiliation, the video was deeply moving. Representative Giffords spoke of the honor that had been hers to bear the trust of the people of Arizona in serving them in the United States Congress. She also spoke of the necessity of giving her time now to her recovery, and she implied that her district needs someone who could be more active in Washington. It was an act of statesmanship. It was also an act that she clearly had undertaken very reluctantly, but she knew that it was right. Americans will continue to pray for Representative Giffords as she presses on in her recovery. Finally, folks in Great Britain are going to witness another moral milestone, or perhaps an immoral milestone. Britain's broadcast advertising body has decided that for-profit abortion clinics can advertise on British television. The Broadcast Committee of Advertising Practice said this past Friday that there was no justification for barring private clinics that offer post-pregnancy services, including abortions, from advertising on television. That is a very telling development. So folks in Britain now will get to see advertisements for fish and chips, advertisements for travel and all kinds of consumer goods, and then advertisements for abortion. Just another service offered to the public. In an observation that should haunt us on multiple levels, our advertising does really tell us a great deal about ourselves. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. You'll find a column written by me on the abortion question and why the abortion issue just won't go away. You'll find it at CNN.com this morning. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, just go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for the briefing.